Okay, so stereochemistry. Stereochemistry is all about isomers. And isomers are molecules that have the same formula, but their arrangement in three-dimensional space is different. And there are many different classes of isomers that you can have depending upon the makeup that we're talking about. So the two of the bigger groups are defined as constitutional isomers. These are structural isomers. These are molecules that, again, has the exact same formula, but in this example here, the fluorine atom is just on a different carbon within that particular molecule. Okay, so another example of constitutional isomer would be 2-propanol versus 1-propanol. Those are constitutional isomers, okay? And the other big category are what we call stereoisomers. And these are molecules that have the exact same bonds, but their arrangement in three-dimensional space is different. And there are two classes of stereoisomers. There are enantiomers, and enantiomers are mirror images of each other. Okay, so when we talked about the D and the L isomer and estilbene, those were enantiomers, okay? Because they were mirror images of each other. And enantiomers, in terms of physical characteristics, are molecules that have virtually identical physical characteristics, same melting points, boiling points, densities, etc. They will differ usually in only a handful of areas. The other class are called diastereomers. This is the larger class of the stereoisomers. These are molecules that do not have, they are not mirror images. And unlike the enantiomers, diastereomers usually have very different chemical, physical properties. Melting points will be different, densities, etc. And so in this example here, we're talking about the cis versus the trans, okay? So that's one example of a diastereomer. And that's the type of molecule that we're going to be doing in this experiment. We're going to be doing a reaction. We're going to convert dimethyl maleate, which is the cis isomer, to the corresponding dimethyl fumarate, which is the trans isomer. Okay, so these are cis and trans. They are diastereomers. And the question first is, how does this isomerization occur? What is the mechanism? Okay, I know mechanism's everybody's favorite subject, all right? And when you think about mechanisms, they can be intimidating. Because a lot of times they can be complex, all right? But when you're trying to figure out a mechanism, it's usually best to go through kind of a systematic, logical approach. You start off with, okay, what's the big picture? You look at your starting material and your product, and you say, what is the big transformation stuff that's happening? And in this case, one of these ester functional groups is rotating 180 degrees. That's the net result, the big picture item out of this reaction. So we have some rotation to get the dimethyl fumarate. Once we've answered that question, now we move on. We say, okay, I need to rotate one of these ester functional groups. Can I do that with hope? In other words, take the dimethyl maleate, stick it on a bench, and say, change. Is it going to rotate without any kind of assistance? And the answer to that is no, because that's a double bond. And if you remember, you don't get free rotation about a double bond. you get free rotation about single bonds. Okay, so we've asked two simple questions, and now we've built ourselves a better picture. In order for this reaction to occur, we first have to break the double bond. That gives us our single bond. You rotate once it's a single bond, then you reform the double bond. There's your product. Okay? So again, simple logical process, two questions. We now have a better picture of what's going on. So we know that we're going to have to break this bond. Well, what do you have in order to break a bond? You have to have energy, okay? And how much energy do we need? Well, I'm gonna try this. First time I'm doing it, did it work? Okay, so if we look at this table here, we see that a carbon-carbon single bond is roughly 83 kilocalories per mole, and a double bond is 146 kilocalories per mole. And so in order to break this double bond, we're either going to need the total amount of the single bond or the difference between the double and the single bond. So it's roughly 70 to 80 kilocalories is the amount of energy we're going to need. All right. So we now know we need energy. We now know how much energy. The next thing is, where is the energy coming from? And let's take a look at the setup. In your test tube, you're going to add the dimethyl maleate. You're also going to add a little bit of bromine. And you're going to put it in front of a light bulb. That's what the little symbol H nu stands for. It stands for light. So hopefully that answers that question I just asked. Where is the light energy coming from? It's coming from light. And H nu is the equation, E equals H nu, where H is, H is Planck's constant, and nu is the frequency of the wave. Another way of writing that is, or another way of saying that, what wavelength do we need to get that 70 to 80 kilocalories per mole? So what frequency? We know that frequency and wavelengths are related to each other. So what frequency or what wavelength do we need to get this amount of energy? So if we look at this table, we see that 80 kilocalories per mole is about 350 nanometers, and 70 kilocalories per mole is roughly 400 nanometers. And hopefully you remember the visible spectrum is between 400 and 700 nanometers, a really narrow range. So we're sitting at the very, very end of one of the sides of the visible spectrum, dipping our toes into the ultraviolet spectrum. And so you do have to ask yourself, hey, I'm putting this sample in front of a GE light bulb for 30 minutes. Is that white light that's being spit out at my reaction going to provide enough energy to break that double bond all by itself? No, it's not. Maybe if we left it in there for an extended period of time, you know, maybe 2-3 days, however long, because we are at the edge of the visible spectrum. So we know over time it would probably work. But certainly within that 30-minute window, there's no way it can work. So something else has to be going on. And if we look back at the setup, the bromine was in there as well. So both of these are in this reaction. So if bromine is there, it's got to serve a purpose. I would love to throw things in a reaction and say, what does this stuff do? You rack your brains for hours and you can't figure it out, and it's just simply, it doesn't do anything. I just threw it in there to confuse you. I'd love to do that, okay? I just can't because I have a budget. So the bromine has a function in the reaction. We've been talking about breaking bonds. So how much energy does it take to break a bromine bond? About 46 kilocalories per mole, which is significantly less than the carbon-carbon double bond. And that happens to fall right around 600 nanometers, which is smack dab in the middle of the visible spectrum. Okay, so again, remember what we're trying to do is come up with this mechanism. And we're doing that by asking some questions and then working our way to the answer. And we now know, in order for this to happen, we have to break the bromine bond. And once that happens, we're somehow going to break the double bond, rotate, reform the double bond. Okay? Well, now we need to know, how do bonds break chemically? So remember, a bond is shared electrons between, A bond is just simply two electrons shared between two atoms. They can break in one of two ways. One of the ways it can happen is both electrons go to one of the atoms, so we end up with a cation and an anion. This is called heterolytic cleavage. The other way it can happen is where one electron goes to one of the atoms, the other electron goes to the other atom, and we end up with two radicals. This is called homolytic cleavage. Bromine can undergo both heterolytic and homolytic cleavage, so we don't really get any help there. We can make a really good educated guess as to how this reaction works, and that is because light's involved. Whenever light is involved in a reaction, there's almost always a free radical floating around in solution. So, what happens is the bromine undergoes heterolytic cleavage to form a bromine atom, or bromide, a bromine radical, excuse me. Now, we know radicals are very reactive. I've always just used this. Electrons are paranoid. They don't like to be unpaired. So if you ever have a radical in solution, that radical is immediately looking for an electron. Doesn't care where it gets it from. And one of the largest sources of electron density is this carbon-carbon pi bond. So we can imagine this, and we end up with this intermediate here. So we have broken the double bond. We have our single bond now. Now we know, hey, we've gotten to that step. We need to rotate. So we're going to rotate, and we end up here. And now we just simply have to get to the product. And this happens very, very easily. One of the electrons comes back from the bromine carbon bond. This electron goes here, and the other electron goes to the bromine. So we end up with our product, dimethyl fumarate, and the bromine radical again. This is a free radical reaction mechanism. So what is this series of two steps called? Starts with a P. Propagation, right? Because remember, you have to regenerate the radical so that the whole process can happen over again. Okay, so that's what we're going to be doing today, or this week as well. again, this is a really simple reaction. Put everything in the test tubes, put it in front of the light for about 30 minutes, and the solid will form. Dimethyl fumarate precipitates out of solution. You're then going to add ethanol to it. You're going to do a real quick recrystallization, cool it back down. The recrystallized dimethyl fumarate, you simply filter, rinse it to get rid of any of the excess bromine that is hanging around. And then we do product analysis, which is, again, the exact same melting point and percent yield. Okay, time-wise, again, this is about an hour and a half-ish long, not very long, so both reactions take about the exact same time. They're both very easy to set up and do. So whichever one you get, you're not really, you know, having to deal with anything major. They're both about the exact same. Good yields in this reaction are about 65 to 70%. Most of you are going to get between 30 and 50%. And the reason for this is the recrystallization. If you add too much of the ethanol, it won't crash out of solution very well. So if you do get a slightly lower percent yield out of this, it's just simply because you added too much ethanol. Okay, any questions with this? Okay, reminder, you have both pre-lab write-ups due when you walk into lab, even though you're only going to be doing one of them. You collect the data, you share it amongst yourselves. So you collect your mass data, melting point data, give it to your partner does it the same. And then you write up both reports, okay? Another thing, we are finishing up the recrystallization and extraction experiment. So you have to get the melting point mass data done this week because that report is actually due this week, okay? So several things due this week. So just kind of keep on top of that because it can catch up to you very, very quickly. All right. Okay. So I've got two jokes today. So I'll try both of them. They're not very good, but what the heck. I had a dad joke about time travel and none of you liked it. All right, yeah. Okay, so this man passes away and there's a major mistake on his tombstone because they misspell his name. And this happens in a small town, so it's kind of a big scandal. And the local paper, the title of the story was Grave Mistake at the Cemetery. Which the family said the newspaper buried the lead. Okay, yeah. Like I said, these are strictly for me. They're terrible. You just have to deal with it, folks. All right, you guys have yourselves a wonderful day, and we will see you in lab.